back, ladies and gentlemen, to the 9-8 podcast, the home of everything progressive and underground right here in Australia. My name is David Ellis, and every fortnight, the man from the Western Coast, Mr. Alex Hogg, joins me. Alex, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. You're back in the full swing of things over there in the West Coast, getting all ready for your wedding's actually coming up, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, last few weeks of a free man.
Well, I've always had a problem with the concept of being like a quote-unquote free man when I've been engaged for 2 years, but whatever.
Yeah. Well, I mean that and, you know, the fact that you do live in Australia where, let's face it, none of us are free people. Well, probably a little more free than some other territories going on at the moment. Hong Kong. What? Right, there's the political reference for the show.
Yeah,
we can skip and done with.
We can skip straight past all of that.
We've got some really, really cool things we're going to be talking about today on the show. As always, starting with some follow-up. Now, Hoggy, you've got something in here about a new IQ record is available to pre-order.
Yes. Now, this record has been a long time coming. The last IQ record was in 2014.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this one is called Resistance. It'll be out on September the 27th, and it is available to pre-order now on CD or vinyl. I had the opportunity to hear one of the new songs that was premiered at Night at the Prog. Sounds fantastic. I also have reason to believe it's going to be available on the next Prog Magazine CD with issue 101 that's coming out. So if you're not a subscriber of Prog Magazine, for Christ's sake, get onto that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Even if it does take like 3 months for us to get issues Australia.
I usually get the issue. By the time the new one is being released, I get the previous one.
Yeah.
So
thanks,
101
Australia
is
Post.
Out. Yeah. Oh, it's not just them, actually. The Americans have get some pretty bad postal coverage on that one as well.
Do they really?
Yeah, they have it even worse than us, actually. Sometimes they take months for theirs to turn up, but that's not Prog Magazine's fault. That's the distribution network they use large multinational that owns the thing. So, yeah, there's that. New IQ record. Check it out. It should be a good one.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So the other piece of follow-up that I have is we mentioned in the interview that I did with Kripke's Illusion a few weeks ago that they had did a cover of Wait for Sleep. I said to them during the interview, I said, you bastards, if you told me you were doing it, I would have recorded it for you.
Hey.
Well, they played a Proclamation gig on Saturday night and they covered Wait for Sleep again. This time they did actually tell me they were going to doing it. I do have a recording of it.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me that they told you you were going to do it and you were in the bathroom or something.
No. Good heavens. Good heavens, no. I wouldn't miss their set for anything. So I do have a recording of that. We will put a link to the show notes to that so everybody can have a look at that.
I think that's just about it for follow-up, isn't it, week? It was just a really, really quick piece of follow-up news, which means that we are ploughing headfirst right into the news.
Yes, and I don't think we could get away from this news topic. just happened today. The new Tool album has leaked. You will not find a link to this in the show notes because obviously we're not bastards.
No.
But apparently the CD version has leaked.
Yeah, so this is the really interesting thing. I actually I got a phone call from a friend of mine last night. I was on my way home from work and he was like, dude, do you want the new Tool album? And okay, I'm not gonna toot trumpets or anything like that, but Hoggy and I are both in this. We've been doing this for some time. We get offers like this all the time. You know, do you want to review this new album? Do you want to review this? Do you want to review this Tool? Well, the new Tool album was one of them. But the thing that's really interesting is apparently the CD version and the streaming version are going to be two completely different versions. So, well, I say completely different. The streaming version is going to have like little interlude tracks and such. It's got about seven or eight minutes of extra content. So the one that's been leaked has been the CD version, which doesn't have all that extra content.
That's interesting. The reason why,
really interesting.
If anyone's interested in why the streaming version has more music on it, is because they physically ran out of room on the CD. The CD is literally at 79 minutes and 10 seconds. So the streaming version is 86 or 87 minutes or something like that.
That's right.
You can't fit all that on one CD. They obviously didn't want to do two. They've put it out extra that way.
Yeah, I mean, there's
and also
few
as
people,
well, it probably gets people to buy both. You know, I'll get the CD and I'll pay for it digitally or stream it or whatever.
Well, I know there's also there's an unboxing video already online for the Deluxe Collector's Whoop-De-Doo edition, the Buy My Wine edition or whatever it is that they're calling it. And that's actually the unboxing video was done by Adam Jones' son, I believe, or something like that. So really, really interesting. But what I did want to take a moment just to talk about this as well. What's your opinion on things getting leaked? I mean, obviously some of the big profile ones. I mean, we've been waiting for this album for 14 years, right? So what's amazing is A, it got to 5 days out from release and then it got leaked. That's surprising. I mean, I'm surprised that we didn't get a phone call like 2 months ago saying, hey, do you want to listen to, you know, some guy coming up to me in a dark alley with a trench coat. Hey, man, I got the new Tool album. You know what I mean?
I have wares if you have coin, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right. The prog Khajiit. I'm actually really surprised they got to 5 days out before a leak came out.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you, like, this is the way that the modern sort of thing works. If you went to Tool a couple of months ago and said you could take... You can take a 5 day out leak. You could take that now if you want. I'm pretty sure they probably have it. They probably, you know, I think big bands expect stuff to leak. It's interesting that the CD version is the one that has leaked. I would have thought it would have been one of the other versions that would have leaked. It's interesting. I thought they would have had the CD version pretty well under lock and key.
Well, in my experience, generally they send out the CD version as the... You know, as the press edition and so on and so forth.
Really, I'd have thought they would have done it digitally because that's how we got when Dream Theater did a media release version. We got that digitally, and it was watermarked and under a password and all that sort of stuff. So I would have thought that would have been the version that they would have gone with.
Mm. Which is another really interesting thing. I'm still at a loss as to how they do the watermarking.
I don't think they'll ever tell us that one.
No, because if you tell us how they do it, then we'll
take it away.
Exactly. I'm really interested to find out how they do it. It must be something like an image file or something like that that they blend in on an audio.
Something in the metadata, perhaps.
Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
But what's your opinion on album leaks and such? Because I have a sneaking suspicion you and I have somewhat of a different opinion on this.
Well. Depends on the size of the band, because the bigger bands, I know the leaking of albums hurts smaller bands. I was actually chatting to my fiancée before we came on air this afternoon, and she mentioned that with Pendragon's last record, that was leaked, and they worked it out and they were able to measure in terms of sales what that probably cost them. It probably cost them... I'll have to get an actual quote on a real number here, but I would probably say it maybe cost them maybe a few thousand copies, which for them is huge.
Yeah, wow.
If they're a smaller band and you're only selling, a few thousand copies or maybe 10,000 copies of a CD and you lose 2,000 of those to a leak, that's a big portion of their income right there. Mm-hmm. You know, let's say Tool lose, people download it or whatever and, if it cost them 2,000 record sales, they're probably like, whatever, big deal, cost of doing business. So I guess it depends on the size of the band where the leak happens. The bigger the band, obviously, the bigger opportunity there is for a leak because there's more people interested in the new Tool record, obviously, than something by Pendragon, for example.
That's true.
Would the leak impact sales? I know there was some study done in the early 2000s that someone worked it out that they thought people who use Napster were more likely to buy music. I'm not so sure that's entirely relevant these days anymore because I don't know too many people who still torrent. Now we have streaming, which is kind of like legal torrenting.
Well, what's actually really interesting is talking about torrenting and streaming and all that sort of stuff. Back when, if you remember the movie torrenting and TV torrenting and all that sort of stuff, back in its heyday was sort of like 2007 through to about 2012, thereabouts. And then Netflix came along and... pretty much wiped the floor and it pretty much stopped everything, right? Same with Spotify. They're sort of the two giants of that industry, but now everything's become so diluted. So music industry is a little bit different because everything seems to be on Spotify and anything that's not on Spotify, you can generally find it on Bandcamp. But in the movie industry and TV industry, you've got Netflix, and then you've got Amazon, you've got Disney TV now, you've Stan. Got Hulu, you've got Stan, and all this shit, right? So I actually know people who have gone, I'm not paying for like 8 subscriptions to things.
Well, it's just like the it's like the bad old days of cable TV then, isn't it? You pay $10 here, $10, $10, and it turns out like $70 or $80 a month, and it's like, hang on a minute, I thought we were doing this to get out from underneath, well, at least in this country, Foxtel.
Yeah, you know? exactly it. And it's not really doing that now. So people are going, well, you know what? Bug ears. I'm just going to...
Well, you have to be a little bit more pick and choose.
I know have gone back to torrenting.
Yeah. Well, you would pay, or maybe pay for some stuff. It's like, oh, okay, I can only afford to pay, you know, let's say $30 or $40 a month instead of $70 or $80. I really want to see this. I really want to see that. And so I'll get Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, and whatever. And all the rest of it is just going to have to go out the back door, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. Mm. So, but it's interesting. You're talking about leaks of bands and all that. I'm somewhat of the. I agree with you in that it matters dependent on where they are. You know, if they're a very large act like Tool, Dream Theater, you know,
Metallica.
We'll get onto them in a second. They can absorb the cost, right? The guys right at the bottom, though, I think it actually helps, because I know plenty of people who discovered bands because, you know, back in the days of Kazaa Lite and LimeWire and all that sort of stuff, they'd go to download, you know, Judas Priest song or something, and turns out it wasn't. It was like Drowning Pool or something, and then they get into that, and then the people would start listening to all this other stuff, and they were sharing stuff, and, oh, I've heard this. Do you know who this song's by? And it was actually really, 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 really cool in that way. And then you've got that mid-tier kind of stuff as well, like Pendragon, Hemina, et cetera, who it probably really does impact because they're losing sales. The guys right at the bottom aren't really worried about sales. Chances are they're still sort of kicking off and they just want fan base at this point. The guys at the top can absorb everything, but the guys in the middle are sort of scraping for everything they've got. I don't know. It's an interesting thing when it comes to this. What I find most interesting about this entire thing is this friend of mine that called me. He goes, you know, do you want the copy of the album? And I sort of went, well, my first instinct was, well, yes. I mean, I've already got a copy of it, so I don't need it. But I'm purposely not listening to it. Because I've waited 14 years, I can wait
What's an extra 5 days when you've been waiting 14 years? Yeah,
exactly. It's not a big thing. And now that this thing's come out with the differences between the two versions, I'm really glad I didn't take him up on the offer, and I'm glad I haven't listened to the press version either. Mm. But it's, I don't know. It's just an interesting thing that's happened. You know, it seems even Tool aren't. You know, immune from the same fate as Metallica.
I don't think anyone is immune to a leak now. I don't think anyone at all. I mean, I can't remember who did it, but someone managed to make an entire record without anybody else knowing about it.
Oh, there was Rihanna.
Yeah.
Rihanna, okay. And she just dropped the new album, and everyone was like,
"Let's say
what
it's
the
Rihanna."
Fuck?
You don't tell anyone. You don't put put press copies out. You don't release anything ahead of time. You just go, "Hey, here's a new record." Bang. That's about probably the only way you're not going to get a leak.
Absolutely, and you know what? That's honestly what I thought Tool were going to do. I thought Tool were just going to get to like mid this year and just go, "By the way, here's the new album," and watch the thing go off its tits.
Or tell people, "Hey, they did it. You know, hey, we got a record August 30." Don't give out press copies, don't release singles, don't do anything, and just sit and watch. Didn't happen, though. I guess maybe the record company got in the middle of it and said, well, we need something.
Yeah, well, that's probably exactly what's happened. Who are they signed to? Are they Sony?
I think so.
Is Sony.
I was going to say, it's either Sony, what? Well, there's only three record companies now, isn't there?
There's only three, so.
It's like Sony, Universal, and who's the third one?
Warner.
Yeah, Warner. Because Warner bought AMI, yeah. There used to be four, but then Warner bought AMI, so now there's three. Or Universal bought AMI. Somebody bought AMI. Yeah, I think it was Warner. Yeah, so you basically got three.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's absurd. It's just absurd.
It is. But, you know, anti-competition laws and all that stuff. Anyway, there's more political stuff that we can get into, which we're going to skip straight past.
Oh, absolutely.
So
interesting. And it really, I mean, the whole history of leaks sort of started off with that whole Metallica and Napster thing.
Yeah, that was a demo that got leaked. So yeah, someone that exactly. was someone inside Metallica's, you know, the big juggernaut that Metallica is. Somebody inside of that leaked it.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And I find that really, really interesting as well. You know, this was sort of the one, and then that obviously brought the whole Napster thing on and everything like that. And,
which kicked off all that stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's interesting because that then, I think that leak probably informed how they did the press release for St. Anger. They invited a bunch of journalists down to an unknown studio in LA somewhere. They said, we're going to play you the new record. No bags, no cameras, no microphones. The only thing you're allowed in the room with is a pen and a bit of paper. Nothing else. No phones, no camera, nothing.
Absolutely.
So they were absolutely sure, they were absolutely damn certain that no one was going to leak that one.
Yeah,
exactly. I don't think it did. I don't think that one got leaked.
No, it didn't. And if it did, then trash cans everywhere were very, very happy that they were using lids as snare drums.
you too about Lars's drum sound. Oh, goodness.
Mate, well, it was fucking atrocious, man. Like, let's be really honest.
Yeah.
It was a bad... That whole album was obscenely badly mixed.
Yeah.
It was actually a good album. Like, and you know me, I don't like Metallica. I've said this numerous times in this podcast. I can't stand them, right? But it's actually a solid album.
Yeah.
So
some of the melodies were a bit meh, and they made some questionable, you know, production choices, but I could see what they were going for. They were trying to sort of, you know, get back to their roots, I guess, you know. Well, they wanted it to sound like, you know, four guys getting together in a garage to jam together for the first time. It just happened to be the four dudes of Metallica, so.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah, for the first time.
Anyway, I think we've done enough yelling about Metallica
for a prog show.
For this one,
anyway.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so, I mean, you know, new Tool albums leaked. Like we said, we're not going to point to where it is on this podcast, but I'm going to sit here and say, normally we would say if you're smart enough, you can go out on the internet, into the internet and find it. And, yes, you can do that. But for God's sake, wait 2 days. At the time this podcast comes out and you hear this, you've got 2 days to wait.
Yeah.
If you're in Australia, if you're in the States, you've got 3 days. If you're in Australia, you've got two. Like, probably
you'll be fine.
Actually,
you'll be fine.
Yeah, exactly. It's less than 48 hours because it'll go live at midnight. So suck it up. Like
exactly.
The rest of us have for the last 14 years.
Exactly.
Right, moving on.
Yes. So there was something that I wanted to mention as a piece of news. There was the worldwide release of a new Rush movie, I guess you would call it, Cinema Strangiato, which apparently is going to be an annual event now.
So what, they're releasing a new album every year?
No. It's not an album. This was like a movie. So there were some exclusive interviews. They played some pieces from R40 Live. There was a section where they did Jacob's Ladder from a sound check. Mm-hmm. So we got some new live performances from Rush, some old stuff.
Yep.
Old as in R40 Live, so it's what, less than, you know, 3 years old at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting movie. I'm interested to see what they're going to do if this is going to become like an annual thing. What are they going to do? What do you think, Dave? What could they possibly do to make this interesting for people to actually turn up? By the way, there were probably less than 20 people at the screening in Perth, which was kind of disappointing, but whatever.
Well, I think this is the issue, right? When you've got, short of making a fictitious movie like we've seen in the last couple of years with, you know, the likes of Bohemian Rhapsody, Rocket Man, Yesterday, etc. There's really only so much you can do with documentaries, you know, especially with bands that are very open with what they do. There's so much information on the band because they write so much stuff about it. They give so many interviews out, like Rush, etc. I feel like there's not a lot you can do. You know what I mean? Like, it becomes a point where you go, okay, just put the big documentary out and just leave it at that, you know? And I don't know how they're going to – I genuinely don't know how they're going to keep it interesting unless they keep releasing behind-the-scenes footage and so on and so forth. But eventually you have to go over old ground. you know? So,
well, especially for them, because people, like, they've been asked in interviews many times, oh, you know, do you have anything left in the vault? And Russia, like, no, there's nothing. We literally have, if it wasn't good enough to put on the record, it went out the window.
That's right. And this is what I'm saying. So I don't think there's much that they can do.
Yeah, unless they go back into the archival stuff, but they kind of already did that with Beyond the Lighted Stage.
Exactly.
And they've already done like a documentation of the last tour with Time Stand Still.
Mm-hmm.
They've done a live DVD of, well, the last four world tours they've done. Rush in Rio, R30, Snakes and Arrows, Time Machine. Okay, five. Time Machine, Clockwork Angel. They've done, you know, live DVDs for probably the last, you know, 15 years.
Yeah.
I don't know what else is left. What else should they do?
Short of them doing another live DVD next year when if they do another tour or something
which
like that.
Which they're
not. You know, which they're
not
going to.
Which is definitely not happening. Getty was asked about that many, many, many times when he was promoting his Big Book of Bass.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, it's not happening anymore. Neil hasn't picked up a drumstick in 4 years.
Exactly.
He put his drumsticks down on August 1, 2015, and that was it.
Then that's my point, right? So this is where you go, okay, so what is the next point of that? Do they, for example, take one of their concept albums and put it forward for a musical, you know, a stage play kind of stuff? Is that the next logical step for them, etc.? Like what people wanted to see with Dream Theater and The Astonishing, which I still think would be actually really good if you interlaced it with an actual story that you can understand because different people are singing the parts.
Yes.
Anyway.
Or doing something like what Roger Daltrey did. I mean, they did Tommy as a stage play.
Yeah, exactly.
And they've done, done Tommy as a stage play. The Wall was a movie as well.
Absolutely, The Wall was.
They turned Marillion's Brave into a movie as well, even though it was done incredibly badly, and I don't actually recommend anybody go and watch it, but...
No, I wouldn't either, but...
Oh, you've seen it, have you?
No, I haven't.
Don't bother.
I don't know, knowing that album and loving that album, I don't know how you could do it.
They did it very badly, no, very cheaply.
Oh my God, how could you do that? That is terrible. But I genuinely don't understand logistically how you could do that with that story.
Yeah,
like, that
fair
doesn't
enough.
Actually make any sense to me. But anyway, unless it was done by like some Spanish director, maybe it was done by a Spanish director.
No, the guy was British, I think. I don't know. I can't remember. I can't remember the guy who did it. But the band wanted them to do it. EMI really didn't want to do it. And they kind of did it, but it was done really cheaply and very badly.
Okay.
And, yeah, people keep asking the band, oh, you know, when are you going to do like a high-def re-release of that movie? And the general consensus from the band, even though they're not saying it that loudly, is no, because we don't like it.
Yeah, well, there you go. So that sounds to me like something like the band licensed the product to them and didn't have any say in anything or didn't even look at the product before it was released on screening night and was like, oh my God, what did we do?
No, that sounds more like the Kiss movie, Kiss Meets the Phantoms or something.
Well,
God, that thing is awful.
not Kiss Saves Christmas.
Well, that was the rip-off. That was the rip-off. That was the...
too funny. But yeah, so answer your question. I don't know how they're going to do it.
Yeah, I'm interested to see. And also for how long. Maybe they do like one or two. And this one was kind of fun. But, you know, the second one, and then they get to the third one, and they go, or they go to do the third one, they go, oh, we haven't actually got anything left. It's all gone. We've gone through the bottom of the barrel. We're not scraping the bottom of the barrel. We've gone through the bottom of the barrel. Now we're scraping at the deck that's sitting on the boat.
Yeah.
So.
Don't know, mate.
It's a fun movie, though. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
You know, some interesting interviews with Getty about his basses and stuff. Because it was interesting. The movie started with almost like a series of ads. Like there was an ad for Gibson. We're talking about Alex's signature guitar line with Gibson, you know, and then Getty had a section where he was talking about it, like talking about the book, you know, how the book was made, you know, they pulled out some interesting basses and it was really interesting. It was quite interesting stuff about the, you know, oh, this guitar was made at this time because it was still using banjo tuning pegs on the back of the headstock and they stopped doing that so we can pinpoint this bass. It was always like a mini antiques roadshow sort of kind of thing. So, yeah. If you haven't bought the book yet, you might want to have a look at that.
Yeah, right. I'll have a look into it, The Big Book of Bass.
Yeah. I do have a copy of it. I just haven't read it yet.
I was gonna say you might have to point me in the direction as to where I can get a copy of it. We can put a link
in the show notes for that one. I'm pretty sure it's available on Rosh's website still.
All right. I'll have a Captain Cook.
Yeah.
But moving on, we've got the Flower Kings have revealed a new double album called Waiting for Miracles. You actually popped this one in here, my friend.
Yes, I did. This one will be available on November the 8th through Inside Out Music.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they recorded this one over the summer. They recorded 15 songs over the summer at a studio in Stockholm, the one that's owned by Benny Andersson of ABBA. So apparently they're getting back to their roots. They're going back to the more joyful and playful style that made the band famous in the 90s. So, yeah, if you're a fan of Roiner's work, it might be one to keep an eye out for when it comes out. November the 8th.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'll have to check that one out myself. Mm-hmm. And you've actually got another one here sort of following that on. I Am the Morning have released a new video as well.
Yeah, they've got a video showcasing one of their songs from the record, The Bell. Okay. It's not actually about Sylvia Plath's The Bell, which is good because, sorry, I have a personal problem with Sylvia Plath. I had to study it when I was in high school and now I can never look at it ever again.
It's kind of like me and Blade Runner. Everyone always craps on about what a wonderful movie Blade Runner is and how fantastic it was. I frankly think it was shit, but that's me.
Fair enough.
I'm going to get a lot of angry emails about that, but anyway.
I doubt it.
The
video for the song 6 Feet from The Bell. It's quite an interesting little video there. We'll throw a link in the show notes. You can check that one out.
Absolutely.
You've got something in here, Dave, about the King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard.
Yeah. I thought this was really interesting. King Gizzard are a band from Melbourne who, for those of you who are listening who don't know sort of who they are, they're kind of like a rock, I don't know, rock grunge psychedelic kind of thing going on.
Big in America, I hear.
Yeah, massive in the States. There's a new album they've got out which came out a couple of weeks ago at time of recording. It came out on August 16th. But the particular – they've released a video game basically as a I suppose a promotional doohickey for the actual album, where you get a gun and you run around an arena and kill rats. And it looks like, you know, sort of mid to late 90s doom kind of thing. And you can play it online. It's free to play online and it's got songs from King Gizzard playing in the background. It's really interesting. I just thought it was an interesting thing to throw in and talk about, because it's very rare that I get to talk about video games and prog music on this podcast. So there you go.
Yeah, it's interesting that I think that there should be a bit more crossover between prog and video games.
Oh, damn right there should be.
Yeah, I don't understand why there isn't.
Well, me neither, to be really honest with you. I know John Petrucci did a thing recently where I think it was like a year ago now, where he played the Super Mario theme with one of the YouTubers that does a whole bunch of metal covers and things like that. So that was really interesting. There is quite a lot of, because it's nerd culture, you know what I mean? And you do find that people who are into video games and all that do listen to, dare I say, more intelligent, in quotation marks. Are you going to hear that, me quoting quotation marks over the
I know where you're going with this.
You know what I mean? More intelligent types of music, generally because they're sort of outcasts and it's kind of that outcast kind of music. So, I don't know. It's just I think there's a lot of crossover there. But, you know, hey, I'm happy to be wrong.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see. We can throw a link to the show notes in that one. I haven't had a chance to play the game yet, but definitely have a look at that. I was never much of a
pretty basic Doom sort of Doom killer sort of thing.
Fair enough.
Doom clone or whatever.
You segued into the thing I was going to. We were trying to have a bit more of a section of more Australian bands and what's happening down under. Given that we are from Australia, we probably should be talking about that a bit more often.
Absolutely.
So, a new single from Hashashin that has been released today at time of recording. So a couple of days. It's been out. This one is called Sahad. I think I'm pronouncing that right. This one is more of this one is the first song that is actually recorded with the traditional instrument, the rebab.
That's a really, really cool sounding thing. I haven't heard the whole track myself. unfortunately, life gets in the way of doing podcasts and things like that on occasions, as I'm sure you're well adept at knowing, Hoggy. Have you listened to it?
I have listened to it, actually. It's really cool. I really enjoy that kind of sort of Arabic Indian kind of music, and Lachlan does it really, really well. So people, that record is coming out very shortly. Go and check it out. These guys are fantastic. I've seen them play live a couple of times. Hashashin have been here on the show. We will chuck a link to their interview that we did with them at Progfest into the show notes.
Beautiful.
So record's coming out. Go and check it out. It's really, really cool. I really enjoy their music, and we should be supporting them a bit more.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. And speaking of support, we have a new tour that has been announced with We Lost the Sea. They've got a new record coming out as well later this year, Triumph and Disaster, which will be out on October the 1st. So they'll be touring around Australia with Tangled Thoughts of Leaving. They will be playing in Perth together. Tangled Thoughts of Leaving and We Lost the Sea will be playing in Perth, Brisbane, Melbourne and Sydney. Tangled Thoughts of Leaving will not be playing in Adelaide, but their Bear the Mammoth will be supporting We Lost the Sea in Adelaide, which are really cool. Actually, I saw them play, saw them open for We Lost the Sea in Sydney a couple of years ago. So that's happening. So check that out. Tangled Thoughts of Leaving, fantastic band live. So if you're going to one of the shows on the East Coast and you haven't seen Tangled Thoughts of Leaving, get down there early, for goodness sake.
Absolutely. Tangled Thoughts of Leaving are very, 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 very good. You all need to go and check those guys out. They're fucking brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
So we'll throw a link in the show notes to some tickets. Now, the tickets will probably sell out relatively quickly.
I would say so.
So, if you're listening to the sound of my voice right now and the tour is still in the future, get on there and get some tickets, because those guys are fantastic. They're only about $30 a ticket, actually, so it's, not terribly priced. It's pretty good stuff. Now, there's one thing here that I wanted to bring up with you, Dave, because you're probably a bit more in the know of this than I am. I saw a tweet from Voyager. And the tweet goes, "So Scotty is working hard to earn some extra money so he can pre-order our new album on the 28th of August.
Yep.
This is the first I'm hearing about it, so what do you know, Dave?
Well, with being sort of friends with some of the people in the band comes certain privileges, and I know for a fact that they're going to announce this tomorrow at time of recording. So I can probably say it on the podcast, which is great. First things first, brand new track going to be dropped on the 28th, which is the day this goes live. And it's going to be exclusively shown on the Racket on Triple J last night at time of release, or tomorrow at time of recording. So on the 27th, it'll be shown. The new song is called Colors. I've actually heard this song. They played it in Sydney. It's awesome, and it is a little bit more 80s synth wave, which I'm about, and I love that sort of stuff.
So they really have let Danny loose on the keyboards again.
Yeah. No one got the big novelty hook and dragged him back, which is good, actually. It's a really, really cool thing, and it's still got that signature Voyager sound that they're sort of bringing over from the last album, Ghost Mile. It's going to be awesome. Now, Voyager as well, they're kicking goals massively. So just for a second, can we talk about the fact that they're doing the Flying Colours tour over in Europe next month, I think, September. They're going to be all around London and so on and so forth. And I know they're playing in Cologne. They're also playing in Barlow in the Netherlands. But the other piece of news as well that I can share, because I am certain they're going to release this information before Wednesday, is that they will be playing Good Things Festival 2019 with some other massive, massive names that are going to be announced on the Good Things lineup this year, including boys from your home city, Carnival. Other absolutely massive, massive names. In actual fact, let's roll into that. Have you seen the lineup yet? Did you get the email with the lineup?
Yeah, I did.
Yep.
Goodness me, here we go. So we've got Parkway Drive and Violent Soho, which are in the list. We've got Coheed and Cambria. They're playing. Yeah. Who else have we got?
We've also got A Day to Remember.
Yeah.
We've got Trivium, Skeggs, some interesting ones in here as well. Simple Plan and the Veronicas. And then we've got some others as well. Enter Shikiri or Shikari. Mm-hmm. I hear it said falling so many different ways.
Falling in Reverse.
In Reverse. Real Big Fish, which is really cool. And, of course, Voyager and Gravemind as well have been announced for the Good Things Festival, which is going to be in three cities this time round. Was it in three last time? I can't remember. I thought it was only in Melbourne and Sydney last time
round. I think this is the first time they'd run it, so...
Yeah. So this time round it's going to be Friday the 6th of September in Melbourne, Saturday 7th of September in Sydney, and Sunday the 8th of September in
December,
Brisbane.
Dave. 8th of December.
Sorry, December. I'm looking at the ticket sales, which is going to be on sale the 5th of September, 10 a.m. local time through Oztix. Definitely worthwhile checking that one out. I'm not going to lie. I'm going to go for Voyager and Carnival. Like, I don't care about the rest, but I'm definitely going to go for Voyager and Carnival. Oh, and Coheed. Coheed and Canberra, because it'll be good to see
Coheed,
those guys.
I've seen Coheed play. They're pretty good. I think I've seen Trivium play as well. They did a festival a couple of years ago. Yeah.
Absolutely. But yeah, I've seen Trivium before. I saw them with Slipknot back in the day. And that was a phenomenal gig.
Yeah, I saw Trivium open for Disturbed several years ago.
Yep.
So they're pretty good.
Yeah, Trivium does the growly, and then David Draiman gets on stage in his, you know, sleeveless shirts and starts going, "Hello, my people!" You know, and starts doing all the dramatic stuff that he does.
And then the wah noise. Which was not inspired by a visit to the Chicago Zoo. I don't know who came up with that one.
Oh, man, I don't know. That's funny.
Yeah. It was on the Wikipedia Fact or Fiction that he did. It was on his Wikipedia page. And
he's
like,
really?
No. Yeah, it was. And they asked him, and he's like, no, who the fuck comes up with this shit?
Oh, man, but it's all good. So it's good to see the boys from Voyager kicking goals. I am aiming to have either Danny or Simone on the show again as it gets a little closer to this, probably after they get back from Europe, so we can have a quick chat about that and talk about good things and how Europe was and everything like that. So stay tuned for that a little bit further down the line.
So speaking of interviews, we prefaced this on the show last time that we had an interview with Joshua Batten.
Yep.
In the release of his new single, Hollywood Blues. Dave, you had a chance to sit down with Joshua not too long ago to have a chat about the new music.
Absolutely. It was really nice of him to give me some time and just to have a chat with him, chat about how he writes and his stuff. Now, I do need to forementioned this. The track is obviously called Hollywood Blues, and yeah, it's blues. It's a modern rock, blues rock kind of stuff in the vein of, you know, Joe Bonamassa and all that sort of stuff. So if you're not a fan of this type of music, then skip to the end of the interview. It mightn't be, you know, your thing. However, if you've even got a slight little bit of interest in anything like that, I implore you to listen to this interview and I implore you to check this track out, because he's a really cool guy and he's a bloody brilliant musician as well. He wrote everything on this album.
And he's a big prog head. I know he's been to...
massive prog head. That's the other thing. That's how we met. He's actually a big prog head, which is kind of really interesting. Although not super interesting, I suppose, because I'm doing the same thing. But it is a very, very interesting thing. So we'll cut to that interview now and we'll chat afterwards. It's very rare on this podcast that we get the opportunity to step outside the prog and metal and more underground type of music and talk about something a little bit, dare I say, more mainstream. However, with Hoggy Away, we had a good friend of the show, Josh Batten, who has been mentioned numerous times on the podcast. And he actually got in touch and said, hey, you know, I do this blues thing. Would you be interested in having a chat with me and hearing the song, the new single I've got coming out and such? And me being a big blues head, I mean, I'm sitting here at the moment in a blue and white and black flannel and you know, a pair of jeans and some Ugg boots, which is probably more, you know, country rock than blues, but you know, Fogarty thought it was good to wear all those things, so I'm going to go with that. So I decided, yeah, come on the show. Whilst Hoggy is away, the cats will play, as they say, the mice will play, I should say, as they say, and have you on the show. So joining me on the show right now is Josh Batten. We're going to have a quick chat about his upcoming single and upcoming album, actually. So, Josh, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Dave.
Oh, that's all right. No worries. Thanks for listening for all this time, too. It's been absolutely brilliant to have some solid fans, and it's good to say that you are one of them. Now, a little bit of a different deviation, as I mentioned there in the sort of preamble. You play in a sort of like a blues rock band. Tell us a bit about that. Tell us a bit about your influences and where it all came from.
Yeah, so depending on how far back you want to go, it's weird because, like, I guess I'm just a music connoisseur. I listen to all kinds of stuff. I've been heavily into prog since my teen years, but around that same time I started getting into the blues world because there wasn't really much happening in terms of prog in my, like, inner circle. Mm-hmm. But through reading classic rock magazine, I discovered Joe Bonamassa. Mm-hmm. And around that time, I was already familiar with Eric Clapton and Jack White and a few others. And I guess that's kind of what I gravitated towards as a young student. We're talking about 2012, 2013 here, so about year 11, year 12, was when I started writing a lot of the songs that ended up on my first album and a couple of songs on the second album as well. Yeah, I guess because I was playing a lot more guitar and I just kind of wanted to write stuff that that reflected my personal struggles. I'll be upfront and say that I do have Asperger's syndrome. Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of my personality and a big reason why I do what I do, because for me, music is very much an emotional haven. It's what drives me to get up in the morning. It's what drives me to be the best person I can be. It's my escape. It's pretty much my everything. So,
So I suppose you mentioned a couple of influences there. One obviously being Joe Bonamassa, who's actually coming to Australia, I think, in September. It'd be interesting. You've got your single launch happening in September, and I think he's here September or maybe it's October. I'm not sure.
Yeah, so I do actually know the dates. I've actually got the magazine behind me.
You came prepared.
Well, I'm prepared for some things, not prepared for other things, unfortunately. he's going to be in Melbourne on September the 23rd at the Palais and doing two shows in Sydney at the State Theatre on September 20th and 21st. I've already seen him three times, actually, twice with his solo show at the Palais. The first time was, I think he just did a 20-minute acoustic set at the start, and then the rest of the show was him and his four-piece band. And then the second time was 2 years later with a Bonamassa Opens for Bonamassa show. So it was the acoustic set, the first half, with all his other guys, and the second half was very much the rock show. And that time he had Derek Sherinian on keyboards, and that's the only time I've seen Derek. So great lineup, with Lenny Casher on percussion as well. Mm-hmm. And the third time I saw him was actually quite a rare one. He did a Bette Davis tribute album with Mahalia Barnes few years back, and they booked in two little shows just at the start of February 2015. One in Sydney, one in Melbourne. I went to the one in Melbourne, and so I was front row center. And so just so crazy to see Joe in this intimate setting. Like, he was just wearing jeans and Simpson sneakers, had his 335. And basically the whole set was him and Mahalia and Lockie Dolly on keys, and Jimmy Barnes did a little guest spot. But yeah, mm-hmm. so it was the Betty Davis Songbook, and to this day, one of the best shows I've ever seen, just because it was so unique and just kind of a one-off thing.
Because I remember that he did a cover of Lazy with Jimmy Barnes, and it was unreal, because that's one of my favorite Deep Purple songs.
Yeah,
and it was brutally good.
Yeah, so I think they recorded that around the Driving Towards the Daylight sessions, because yes. They also did Too Much Ain't Enough Love, which in my opinion, Joe's version with Jimmy on vocals, it's much better than Jimmy's original, which is so 80s and so cheesy and so mm-hmm. sad. Whereas mm-hmm. Whereas the one on Driving Towards the Daylight is actually sad but good sad, if you know what I mean. Like it's like yeah. it's actually got the blues element, and the connection there is very much Kevin Shirley. So Kevin Shirley, who's produced Joe's last few records mm-hmm. and worked with Cold Chisel, and he did Counterparts with Rush, he did Falling Into Infinity. Mm-hmm. So he kind of crosses between all those worlds. And I guess if there's one producer who I'd love to work with the most, it's Kevin Shirley.
Yeah, because, I mean, his overall sound, and I think I mentioned this when I watched the original video you sent me of your upcoming single, which, by the way, is entitled Hollywood Blues, and I love the title and I love the track. It's absolutely fantastic.
Thanks so much, man.
The Bonamassa really came through. So, and that was very, very surprising. I mean, aside from the fact you're using a PRS, and that's fine. I'll forgive you for that, being a music band person. but they, I mean, it really, really came through. So, I mean, your big influence obviously is Joe, is JB. You mentioned a couple others though. You mentioned Clapton. You mentioned, was it Jack Bruce? I think you said as well.
I mentioned Hendrix. I'm not a huge okay. Hendrix fan, though I did get Are You Experienced as a on vinyl as a birthday present when I was 18, and that's still one of the one of my top debut albums of all time.
Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic album, really. I mean, Hendrix is – I'm a bit like you. I'm not a huge Hendrix fan, but his stuff was definitely revolutionary, kind of like Marshall. You know, Jim Marshall, his Marshall amplifiers, not a big fan, but were they revolutionary? Yeah, they are. They still are.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal.
And it's funny, and that's me with a lot of acts, actually. Like, my musical upbringing was kind of wonky. So, like, the first rock band I really was a huge fan of was actually the Electric Light Orchestra.
Yeah, okay.
I discovered them when I was 7, and then from there, so I was just listening to whatever my dad was listening. This was around the time we got our first DVD player, and so dad was getting all these DVDs. So he had Hell Freezes mm-hmm. Over by the Eagles, which I never really got into. But we had The Dance by Fleetwood Mac, and for me, Lindsey Buckingham was kind of the first guitar hero I had, followed in short order by Brian May, mm-hmm. Queen at Wembley. And so kind of those three were kind of the three that I listened to the most from age 7 to 8. And then around that time I started listening to other music as well, or just whatever was in my dad's collection, basically. So I got into the 80s era Genesis. It wasn't until I was a teen mm-hmm. until I discovered, like, the classic Genesis. And I was a massive Beatles nerd as a kid and still am. Yeah. But honestly, I didn't really – the one band that I've never been, I guess, like, a super, super fan of is Led Zeppelin, which is, I guess, strange to me personally. But I guess they just weren't as big a deal. And also because a lot of my musical influences came from Rock Band and Guitar Hero, and obviously we all know how Jimmy Page and Robert Plant feel about lending their music off to licensing and stuff.
Yes, yes.
So it's like, so I was kind of restricted to what was available through that. And I kind of went through a bit of a period of retirement from about age, from year 6 to year 8, where, like, mm-hmm. no one was really showing me anything. And I was pretty much just stuck with the stuff that I was doing, and I was just focusing on schoolwork. Mm-hmm. But around that time, but after that, I started getting back into music, and through older friends at school, I discovered Pink Floyd and mm-hmm. Discovered UMI and discovered Green Day, a very mm-hmm. weird combination. But then a friend of mine gave me Yes songs, and that was like my kind of introduction to the whole super prog world. And at that time, I just was not used to listening to such long songs. I was more looking at the time code rather than actually taking in all the music. Yeah. But the band that finally did it for me was Rush. To kind of bring it back to your original question of influences, I'd say Rush has been an absolutely huge influence. And probably when I discovered them, which was through Guitar Hero 5, they were the. It was like when I'd like. It was like I'd found the band I'd been looking for my whole life, basically.
Yep. I know that feeling. That was the same feeling I had with Dream Theater back on. When I was, what was I, 13 when they released Train of Thought. And that was the same. This was it. You know, it's like, okay, that's it. That's it. But you're right. Influences are far and wide. So let's talk about really quickly this this single you've got coming out. I mentioned it earlier. The title of it is Hollywood Blues. And the lyrics are absolutely fantastic. It is very... very much modern blues rock, and it's an absolutely fantastic, fantastic track. Tell us about a bit of the influence behind the title and the lyrics for this particular song. Aside from it being a straight up, you know, blues rock song with a meaty guitar solo and everything else like that, what's the meaning behind it?
Yeah, I think, well, the first thing I came up with was the chord progression. It just basically, I think I was listening to Straight On by Heart. That was a bit of an influence on this track. And I guess there's a little bit of Santana in there, and it's taken a bit of time to grow. So I actually started writing this song around 2011, 2012. And the riff itself, the main riff, was really inspired by a song called Ebony Eyes by Bob Welch. And at the time I was really getting into hard rock, and I actually had that riff with like a kind of a thrashy double bass kind of thing going on in my head. And I thought, you know, I was just coming up with different riffs here and there, and I had a like, and at that time it was just, it was really thrashy. But then I thought, you know what, let's kind of bring it back a bit and bring it and kind of, I guess, make it a bit sturdier and a bit gentler. And I combined that with this chord progression I'd had for a few months. And having the two sections kind of going back and forth were almost like a call and answer thing. And call and answer is pretty much what the blues is all about. So even though it's not necessarily call and response in the vocal department, it's definitely call and response in the different sections. And lyrically, I was listening to a lot of American blues at the time and a lot of American rock and roll. And I think I'd just come back from my first trip over to the US, went over there for a skiing trip with my family, and actually ended up seeing The Wall at the Honda Center by Roger Waters. So that was the first time I got to see it. And so back to the song. So when I got to LA, I think the first day there it was kind of rainy, really just gloomy. And I think it was pretty much like that for the whole 2 days I was there. And it made me realize just like they talk up America so much in TV and in books and in film. And it's like you finally get there and it's like, well, it's not all it's cracked up to be. And at the same time, there's also for every success story you hear, of somebody who went to LA, made it big, there's probably about 100 others who are just struggling to make a living out there. So this was kind of a warning to myself, really, just not get in over your head. And a lot of my songs are really just letters to myself and warnings and thinking about anxiety and thinking about what could potentially happen if I don't take stock of everything and take a step back. So this is really about the song is very much about a guy who's just trying to make it in the big city, and it's kind of just all falling apart. He's the 99%.
Absolutely. It's funny you mentioned your experience with the US, and that was exactly my experience with the US as well. When I got there, and I wound up in Nashville for a little while there as well. I was bit fortunate to have my session stuff behind me as well, and someone who knew me and gave me a shot over there, which was really good. No, I had the same thing. The US really didn't impress me all that much. Particularly LA was a hole.
The second time back, the second time I went there was actually the opposite, like super bright, super plastic, so many like royal blues. It was and and bright colors. It was just, yeah, it was too much. So.
I wasn't a big fan. New York as well left me a little bit cold. But that said, I'd still like to go back and see it again, maybe take the camera over this time and do some photography and such.
Yeah.
Go on, sir.
Ironically, the American response to this song so far, of the people who have heard it, they all seem to love it, I guess. I guess because it's catchy and because it's an enjoyable, it's an upbeat, listenable song, mm-hmm. I guess is why people seem to really enjoy it.
Mm. It is a very, very enjoyable song. And it's you know, a hell of a lot of fun to listen to as well and to sort of sing along to, and I haven't worked it out yet, but I was going to grab the guitar out and see if I could figure it out as well.
I'll tell you one thing about that it does use the Hendrix chord at the start.
I figured that's what it was. I heard it and went, yeah, okay, that's a Hendrix chord, definitely. So with this particular song, let's talk about some of the technicalities behind the track for a minute. Mm. Live drums, I presume. They sounded like live drums. Normally, when I've seen videos of you playing, you've got yourself, a bassist, a keyboardist, and a drummer. I couldn't hear any keys in this track, but maybe that was just me not listening hard enough. Did you drop them for this track, or was it, you know, were they just in the background? And sort of, how'd you go about recording it? Where did you record it? Where'd you record this single? And who played all the instruments? You know, how did it all come about?
Yeah, okay. So there's a bit of a long story to this one. So this album that I've just finished is, there's 10 tracks that make up the actual album itself. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, there's two encore songs. And this happens to be one of the encore songs. And what I mean by that is that they're not really bonus tracks, because I still think they're just as good as the other tracks. But these are two songs that were on my first acoustic demo, which I recorded about 5 years ago, and I just never updated them. If I had the hindsight, I probably would have included them on my first album, but I was a bit strapped for time, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to write 100 more great songs, and I'm not a very prolific writer, but I still really believed in this track, and it's kind of been gestating in my head for a while. So when I put my first band together, which was the band that played on my last album, Searching for Answers, which was the bassist, the drummer, and the keyboard player that you saw, this was one of, I think, probably the only non-album track from my earlier days that I put in the set, because I thought it was a really great track and I thought we should still play it. And originally the idea was that this group of four guys, including myself, would become a proper band, and that we would start working on something that was kind of a cross between blues and prog, and we would kind of bounce off each other. Unfortunately, I've never really been great with the whole band democracy thing, and I get very anxious and very protective over my own music and a little bit defensive when it comes to hearing other people. I try to keep an open mind, but long story short is that band is now done and dusted. The drummer Shane is the only one who I still kind of work with in that capacity. So Shane McMahon, who played drums on my first album, actually plays the drums on this new track, on the new recording of Hollywood Blues, and everything else is me. So I recorded it at Highway 9 Studios in Croydon with Sean O'Sullivan, who, again, I worked with on my last record. And this was done kind of in conjunction with all the other tracks. So it's taken a long time to get this thing up and running. But in terms of equipment and stuff, in terms of tracking, so, yeah, there's some MIDI keyboards going on just kind of in the background. Because I wasn't prepared to fully give up the keyboard aspect just yet. But there's a lot of guitar overdubs on there. I started off recording it on a Fender Stratocaster, which is the 60th anniversary channel bound model. And I started off with that. And then, so I think that's probably what you're hearing on the clean stuff. But Sean said, well, why don't you use the Paul Reed Smith for the more heavier stuff? And I thought, because I used the Pori Smith so much on the last record, that this one was going to be more of like a Strat-y kind of record with more emphasis on the singer-songwriter stuff. But we ended up plugging in the PRS, and it basically does – it's the best of both worlds for me personally. It's everything rolled into one, this Custom 24 that I've been using for the last 7-8 years, I'd say. And – so, yeah, that's what you're hearing on, like, the distorted guitar, and that's what I used on the guitar solo.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it sounded like to me that you had some double tracking and such going on. Specifically, my question is, so you've got the clean guitar section, which sounds like a singular guitar, sounds like just one, maybe sort of dropped straight down the center. When all the gain and everything comes in, it sounds like two guitars panned left or right. I don't know if they're panned hard or if they're panned mostly hard left and right. But then the way that you control the dynamics in the track is really interesting as well. So you've also got – it sounds like when, for example, when the solo comes in, that the gained guitars on the hard left and right almost shift towards the center, and then you pan out – the lead guitars left and right. So that means either you double tracked it or maybe you used two microphones and panned them hard left and right. So how am I going? Am I on the money or am I completely wrong?
You're a lot more technical than I would have been. A lot of the credit for this for that production does have to go to Sean O'Sullivan, who really brings out the best in me. And one thing I think with all my tracks with Sean, we start with just me and acoustic guitar. It starts with just a guide vocal and a guide acoustic. And then I think for all the guitars, I think for every guitar track, we do at least two takes at the same time. So I think everything's just about everything's doubled except the guitar solo and except the bass and obviously the drums and stuff. But yeah, double tracking is a big thing. He really likes getting that whole, I guess, kind of wall of sound happening. So I'm fine with that as well. And so the challenge, I guess, for me is just kind of trying to play the same thing a couple of times to make it sound really good.
I understand.
Precise. Yeah.
I was going to say, I understand that. That is, it can be quite a daunting task. Especially if you're paying for studio time as well, because you feel really under the pump.
Absolutely.
Now, one thing, I've just pulled up your press release here for the Evening with Josh Batten Hollywood Blues single launch, which is going to be on September the 19th, 7:30 at the David Williamson Theatre in Paran. I assume that's how you say it. Paran. There you go. You can tell immediately that I'm from Sydney because I have no idea how to say anything that is down in Melbourne. Now, a paragraph in here that caught my eye was, in addition to Music on the Night, both photographer Jason Rose Warne and graphic artist Renee Garling will be displaying their work in the foyer. Drinks and finger food will also be available.
Yeah.
Is this something that's quite common in Melbourne, where you have these multi-layered art events, I suppose? So you have live music and you have some photography and you have some graphic arts going on and blah, 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 blah. Because obviously with the situation in Sydney where pretty well the whole art scene has just shat itself.
Yeah. Well, I guess this is really something I've been working on for at least a year, I suppose. Like ever since I knew I was going to do a second album, I knew I wanted to have a big launch show for it. And my dad, who's my biggest supporter and probably my my business partner in this whole thing, he had the idea of not only doing a show in a theater where with a serious focus on all my songs on from both albums and some of the new stuff as well, and actually getting a group of talented session musicians behind me, but he also wanted to give some showcase to some of the people involved. So I went with a whole new creative team on this record. On my last record, I had basically just, I think my bass player's girlfriend took the front cover photo, and then I just used some basic graphic design stuff. No disrespect to their work, but I wanted to go the extra mile. I really was inspired by artworks like the band Mood Dog Matinee a few others, where it's like it's almost like this airbrushed surrealist landscape in a way. So Jason Rosewarne is a photographer in Melbourne, and I've known him for about a year now. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. he has been a great friend and a great supporter of my music. And so when I said, you know what, I'm going to do some photography for the next album cover, he was the no-brainer. He had to be involved. Mm-hmm. But I said, you know what, I kind of want to go a little bit of a step further with that and get some actual pen and ink artwork happening as well, or paintbrush and canvas. And he scoured Instagram and found Renee for me. And Renee has a very kind of distinct style, which varies up from artwork to artwork. But when you see the artwork that she's done, the framework is just absolutely beautiful. And we've kind of gone with a bit of a Goodbye Yellow Brick Road thing, in that every song has its own piece of artwork. And we're doing this. I'm holding that booklet and album here. I've got an advanced copy, and there's like a 16-page booklet with it. And Renee's done these amazing little vignettes for each of the songs. So the idea is just, I want to be basically, I make music because it's how I connect with people, and it's what I want to do. It's what I want to do. It's how I want to connect, and I just want to, I guess, give back to the people who've helped me out. So this is very much an opportunity for me to celebrate, I guess, this celebrate the work of my friends as much as myself. And because art comes in many forms, like you said, and I think these guys are very essentially performing with me on the night. And I hadn't thought of it like that as like a whole multimedia thing. For me, this is just a big show to really kind of premiere the album, essentially, because I wanted to get this album out a lot sooner, but also want to do like a proper press run for it and get some PR behind it. And I can't put out anything over Christmas. So at the moment, we're probably looking at about February for the actual release date online and stuff.
Beautiful.
Well, I'll have a few advanced copies, I guess, on the night of the show. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but
that's right. We can cut that. No, if you want me to cut that, that's fine.
Yeah, but it's probably the biggest thing I've ever tried to put together. And I've got an amazing team of musicians behind me.
That's good. That's good. Obviously, Melbourne is a bit of a better place to find halfway decent musicians and such than Sydney is. And it's great that there is still at least a city or two in Australia that's doing some halfway decent stuff. So I suppose, look, we'll wrap this up. We'll bring this to a quick fade, as Hoggy would say. But one thing I do want to ask is, you know, as a listener of the show, we generally do one album that you should listen to. What's an album that our listeners should listen to from your collection, I suppose, in your brain rattling around there?
I'd like to pick, a new single that's just come out by mates of mine. They play in a band called Neo Relic. I think they play... Yeah.
Oh, yes. I know what you're going to say for this one. Please keep going.
Yeah. So they've got a new song out called Remember Me, which absolutely kicks ass. And I was completely blown away. I didn't know what to expect because I've been friends with these guys for a little while and they're just such nice people and they really love what they do. In terms of albums, it's not out yet, but I'm waiting on my copy of the new album for a band called District 97, who I think... I don't know if you've spoken about them on the show at all, but they're from Chicago, and their lead singer, Leslie, was on American Idol about 10 years ago.
Right.
But she's completely broken out of that mold, and I actually saw them on Cruise to the Edge when I went over there in 2017. And they were quite close with John Wetton, actually, before he passed away. And they did a whole live album together. So they've just finished a new album, which I'm sure is easier to come by if you live in America. They did a whole crowdfunding campaign and I was one of the backers for it. So I'm waiting on my copy and definitely interested in hearing what they've come up with this time around. But the stuff they've done up to this point is fantastic because there's a lot of female fronted prog out there, but not much coming from America. And these guys just happen to be doing it in a smart and unique way. And at some point I'm going to have to come back because there is a lot of prog stuff that I want to talk to you about.
Absolutely, absolutely. We can definitely save that for another time. Josh, thank you so much for joining us here on the 9-8 podcast. Well, today it's today, we will see you. Hope all goes well for the launch there in September. I might even see if I can get some tickets and fly down for it. So, Josh, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, David. Great to talk to you.
Thanks. Likewise.
So there we are, Dave's interview with Joshua Batten. Good stuff there, Dave. It was a very interesting interview.
Thanks, man.
Even some stuff that I didn't know about Joshua's music. So
yeah, and some stuff that probably some people didn't know about Josh. So
exactly.
You know, as I said, all around cool guy. You can check out his new single, Hollywood Blues, on all your major streaming services and so on and so forth. And his new album will be coming out in the not too distant future. Now, moving onwards, I suppose, to our main topic of today. We've been receiving some emails from some people talking about, hey, you know, when are you going to throw your 2 cents in on this album? Or when are you going to throw your weight behind this album? Or when are you going to talk about this? Blah, 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 you know? So when Hoggy went overseas, and I think I mentioned this last fortnight in one of the two episodes last fortnight, there were about 150 albums that were released in that two-month period that Hoggy was away. It's really hard for us to keep up with absolutely everything. So what we're doing this one, and we're going to do a little bit of a condensed version of some pretty critical albums that we think we need to talk about from the first half of this year. So we've got a few sort of lined up here, and we're going to sort of go through them and have a quick chat about them. We hope that's all right.
There are so many. This is the thing. There is so much new music out there. We probably don't need to tell you that. You know that as well as we do, that there's a lot of new music out there from all over the world, and we can only cover so much. And we obviously try and cover more Australian things because that's where we are. We're a little bit closer to the scene here. But there's a few. I mean, there's a couple of big records here that we completely just didn't have time to cover on the show. The biggest one of them all for us concerning the prog world, probably the Neil Morse Band. We talked about their lead single from The Great Adventure, but we never actually got around to listen to the whole record. What did you think of the record itself, Dave?
I really like the Neil Morse Band, all right? I like Neil Morse as a person. I like his music. I like the fact that when I dial into or turn on a Neil Morse song, I know exactly what I'm going to get. On the other hand, that's why I don't like Neil Morse, because I know exactly what I'm going to get.
Yeah, there's definitely a Neil Morse sound that comes along with much of the prog stuff that he does. Even some of the stuff he does with Transatlantic, you can definitely hear, oh, right, that's the bit. That's Neil's bit.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know, I really like this album. The Great Adventure was a very, 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 very good album. I really enjoyed it quite immensely, actually. But he hasn't really progressed
I was going to say, that sounds kind of snobby to say that. But I think one of the great strengths of what I think, going away from just doing solo records, especially with the last solo record he released as Neil Morse, Momentum, if you look at the documentary of it, you could definitely see that Mike and Randy were really starting to kind of get more into the writing of it, but it was still ostensibly credited to being written by Neil. So maybe on the back of that one, Momentum, in 2012, he was like, well, maybe I just need to go all in here and incorporate people like Eric and people like Bill Hubauer and Randy and Mike into the actual writing of it and try and get more of a collaborative effort.
Yeah. But I think
came through on the Grand Experiment. The Grand Experiment definitely went off into a different place. That one was a lot heavier than I was expecting.
Yeah.
Neil's not really a metal guy. He's definitely like a prog guy. He's not really like a metal guy.
Yeah.
Whereas you've got guys like Eric and Mike Portnoy in the band. They're metal guys, obviously.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, you know, Eric Gillette, who, if you closed your eyes, you'd swear you were listening to JP. And Mike Portnoy is Mike Portnoy. So
exactly. Exactly.
You know, but it's, I don't know. I really enjoyed the album. Out of five, I'd probably give it a four.
Yeah, it's going with that.
You know, it's a very, very enjoyable album. It is typical of a Neil Morse album. You turn it on, you hear exactly that. Was it lacking anything? Not really. Did it hit everything out of the park? Not really. You know what I mean? It wasn't like I listened to it. I think
the other problem
as
well was with a double CD. This would be astonishing as well. It's a double album. It's kind of like, well, there's always going to be kind of a bit of fill in there somewhere because it's a double album.
Unless you hit it out of the park. So, I mean, there are obviously albums where, you know, it required it, or you've got too much idea for one particular album. But don't do a double album where you've got, for example, you know, six songs on one and six on another just to say, oh, look, I've got a double album. You know what I mean?
I think that's probably just the part of it where it just doesn't fit on one CD. The Wall is like that, actually. Ostensibly, that's a double CD album. But that's only because it's like 3 or 4 minutes too long for one CD, even though it was originally done on vinyl.
Yeah, that's right. But it is look, I enjoyed it. I would recommend it to other people, but I wouldn't necessarily. It's not something I would be breaking my neck to listen to again.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Yeah. However, one I think we do really need to talk about, because the amount of times I have been asked, are you going to review this album, by people I know is, it's doing my head in, so I'm going to bloody hit the nail on the head now so I can get stopped asking about it. Periphery 4, Hail Stan.
Yeah.
Have you listened to it?
I did listen to this one, actually. I kind of like it. I was just surprised, actually, how much Spencer sounds like Chester Bennington.
Yep.
There's a lot of Chester. I was thinking, I was listening to this album with my fiance, and I said to her, am I going to be an asshole if I say he sounds like Chester? And she's like, no, I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he does, particularly when he's doing his singing and all that. His screaming is very, well, he doesn't really scream, he growls, unlike Chester, who sort of sounded like he was tearing vocal cords, which he was.
Totally.
But, you know, I mean, Periphery are one of those bands where I've seen them a couple of times live. I really enjoy listening to them. I really enjoy their music. But I'm one of those people who goes, I like what you're doing, but if you could just knock off the growly bits and replace them with singy bits, I might be more interested. There seems to be this thing at the moment, particularly in prog and metal music, where if you're not growling, it's not prog or metal. And I don't get it. It doesn't.
Maybe because it's, I don't know, maybe. I'm going to show up here my musical, non-musical side here. Bit of me that's not a musician. Is it easier to do the growling?
No.
Is that like, you know, because all the high stuff requires, you know, actual ability to sing and get up there and hit the notes.
Growling requires a lot of ability. A lot, because it's not. So growling.
I know if you do it wrong, you can completely ruin everything and just completely stuff your voice right out the back door.
Partly why. But as well as that, you're not actually growling from your throat. You're growling from like just above, almost just like your diaphragm, basically. So it's a very, very different technique, and you have to sort of learn it over many, many years. There's actually a really good video Jared Dines on YouTube does, where he goes around and challenges people to give them their best growl. And he says something like metal. It's called like metal screaming is easy or something. And have a look at that, because it's really apparent when you hear someone who actually knows what they're doing and someone who doesn't. You go, okay, yeah, that's a very different thing.
Is that the video that's called Metal Screaming Doesn't Take Talent?
Yeah, that's it. That's the one.
I just typed in Jared Dines growling onto YouTube and found it. So
that's the one.
Yep. So we can throw a link to that in the show notes.
Awesome.
To that video, because he's got a damn good point there. Yeah. So the other big album that I wanted to mention, unless you've got anything else to say about Periphery.
Nah, not at all, man.
Okay. The other big album.
I will. 3 out of 5. Okay. Three and a half out of five.
Cool. Yeah. So the other big one that a lot of people have been wanting us to talk about is Queensryche, The Verdict.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think I'm talking out of school here when I say that Queensryche kind of lost their way for a bit when they went into the jet, you know, pretty much from, I'm going to say from probably Operation Mindcrime 2 all the way to the point when they kicked Jeff Tate out of the band.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of lost it. Yeah, you know, Jeff Tate took over the band. He was doing his songs. He didn't want to do the metal. He wanted to do his other shit.
Shit being the
operative word here. They booted him out of the band. They got Todd Latore in, and they've done two records now with Todd Latore. This is the second one. This one is fantastic. Queensryche are back. They're back doing the stuff that made them big in the late 80s and the 90s with Operation Mindcrime, with Rage for Order. Fantastic record. And Todd Latore plays drums on this record too. Scott Rockenfeld was unavailable to participate in this record for family reasons.
Yeah.
So Todd played drums on this record as well. He did a fantastic job. It's a great record. You all need to check it out.
Yeah, it is. It is brilliant. Queensryche to me have always kind of been Iron Maiden, but not.
Certainly in the early days, I think they certainly drew inspiration from a lot of that sort of, you know,
but even this
heavy
album,
metal, British, you know, new wave of British heavy metal, a lot of power metal sort of stuff.
Yeah, this album still, there's a lot of that coming through, and I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I'm not saying I wouldn't listen to them because, you know, blah blah blah. I think it's great. Is it necessarily something that I would reach for if I had my vinyl collection there and it was there? Would I necessarily reach for that over other stuff? I don't know. But it definitely does serve a place, and I think it's an absolutely fantastic album, and it's really good to see them sort of back, as you say, as a return to form. It's bloody good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I know there was a lot of crap with the court case and stuff when they booted Jeff out of the band, and then there was a suing, and then there were two versions of Queensryche and all that. That crap's all done now. Jeff's off on his own. He's got his own band, Operation Mindcrime, who are releasing records as well. None of them I think are particularly good, but that's just me.
Other people
seem to like them, I guess.
The other thing you got to remember as well is, and this is probably, here's Dave's lesson for the podcast. You got to figure out what's an album name and what's a band name. You know,
yeah, I
Operation
think because
Mindcrime is not a band name. That's
the problem.
An album
was
name.
He had to call it something, and because he got the rights to perform Operation Mindcrime 1 and 2, Operation Mindcrime and Operation Mindcrime 2 in its entirety, kind of like the deal that Roger Waters got when he left Pink Floyd. He got to perform The Wall all the way through. He got the rights to perform that all the way through. So he figured, well, if I got the rights to perform it, I might as well call it the bloody band and give it some sort of brand recognition out in the market, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, you know, but yeah, still, anyway, is what it is. Now, you've got two other albums in here as well that you've popped in here. One of which we mentioned this band earlier, which is I Am the Morning. The Bell was their album they released earlier this year. What do you think of it?
I enjoy listening to I Am the Morning. It's definitely a very different. The other three albums we've talked about are definitely metal albums. This is most definitely not metal. This is very much off, way out into the other end of the spectrum, with a lot of sort of chamber folk and kind of, you know, classical, very classically inspired, understandably, given that they're both Russians. So I really enjoy listening to that kind of music. Is it necessarily for everybody? Well, as we've discussed on this show before, there's kind of two camps of prog. You've got the metal guys and you've got the non-metal people. So this one probably more appeals to people. If you're into prog, but you're not necessarily into metal, this one might be more your speed. And I would happily say the same thing about the second one as well that I've put in here, which is a collaboration between Mark Zonder, he of Fate's Warning fame, and Gary Verkamp of Shadow's Gallery fame. Shadow Gallery fame.
Yep, Zonder Verkamp, yeah?
Yeah. So this album is, you would expect that, like, Mark Zonder being the gun drummer that he is and Gary being the gun guitar player and keyboard player that he is, you'd expect lots of proggy riff kind of stuff. You don't get that with this record, actually. This is more off onto the other side, more melodic prog rather than straight out, you know, sort of heavy, lots of technical riffing prog. Very interesting record. If you like that sort of stuff, you probably should check this record out as well. If you're a fan of Shadow Gallery, you probably should check that out as well. Are you familiar with Shadow Gallery?
I am, yeah.
Excellent. So there's a Zondervan. You probably wouldn't have seen that one about. It is on Spotify if you want to check it out first before you buy it. I did actually buy the record myself, so it's a really cool record. If you'd like, again, the sort of melodic kind of prog stuff, you should check that out.
Yeah, absolutely. This is definitely up my alley as well, this melodic prog kind of stuff, which I very, very much enjoy. I mean, I've banged on about many melodic prog bands on the podcast before, including, you know, a lot of stuff from Sydney and a lot of stuff from England. So, yeah, lots and lots of fun. So, I don't know, are there any others that you think that we really need to mention? Because they're basically the ones that we keep getting asked about.
I don't think so. I don't think there was anything. If you've got something else that you want us to talk about, that you know, a big record that we've missed or that we haven't discussed, please get in touch with us. Send us some feedback. Tweet at us. We are at 98FM, all one word. I'd like to get some conversations happening on Twitter. If you are on Twitter, we have an email. You can send us an email. There's a contact form on our website at the98podcast.fireside.fm. Send us some emails there. Love to hear what you guys have got to say.
Beautiful. Absolutely. All right. Well, I think that sort of brings us to our
album reviews.
Now, last week, Hoggy, I gave you a single by
yes,
a band
did.
Called Magic Pie. The single is called The Man Who Had It All. What did you think?
Well, on the show, I said that I hadn't heard this particular song. It turns out I have, actually, because it was on one of the prog CDs, one of the more recent ones, actually. I have listened to this one. I really enjoy this single, actually. I thought it was a really, really cool song.
It was very Neil Morse.
Yes,
ironically.
Very much so. Very much, yeah. Very much of that, you know, that sort of melodic prog, a lot of, you know, organs and stuff like that. So, yeah. On the complete other end of the spectrum, though, I gave you a live album by a Bulgarian metal band called Odd Crew, live at the Hristo Botev Hall. What did you think?
Right.
I don't like the sound of that.
No. My issue with the album, when the guy started singing properly, this goes back to my non-love of, you know, screamy. When the guy started singing properly, he had a voice sort of a bit like Corey Taylor from Slipknot. I actually really enjoyed that. The music was pretty standard metal kind of stuff. You know, it was basic, all intents and purposes, it was a straight up metal album, right? I kind of got bored by about track 5 because it all sounded very similar. And that's kind of the thing with that sort of metal, that kind of even like dance music and all that sort of stuff that's a bit repetitive. You kind of need the atmosphere to go along with it, and which is half the reason why if you ever listen back to a lot of live recordings and such that you were at, you go, actually, that was not as awesome as I remember it because you were standing in the crowd yelling at the top of your lungs with everyone else. So I imagine seeing these guys live would be a very different kettle of fish to actually listening to a live recording of them. I also took the liberty of listening to one of their albums as well, which was the one from this particular, the tour for this particular album, you know, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
Same sort of thing. Production was a little bit lacking, I thought, to be really honest with you. They definitely seem like they're a better live band than they are a studio band, which is a rare thing to say these days.
Mm.
I
think mostly because I think they're mostly self-produced.
That'd be it. Yeah, it was definitely mixing. It was missing something, and I couldn't remember exactly. I couldn't sort of figure out exactly what it was. But overall, I would definitely show it to people. If someone came to me and was like, "Hey, man, I'm a metal fan. Have you got anything that you'd be interested in?" I'd be like, "Yeah, check these guys out." You know, but I wouldn't necessarily give it to a prog snob.
Fair enough.
I suppose for me, it'd be sort of 3 out of 5 would be my rating of it. But that's just my opinion, and please, all the Bulgarian fans listening to this, don't hate me.
You're not going to get that much hate. The hate is oversold. So we come along to this week's album reviews. What have you got for me this time, Dave?
All right. I discovered these guys during the week. I'm hoping, like hell, you haven't heard of these guys. They're called Socionic, so as in socio and then Nick at the end. So like sociopath, but without the path, and put Nick at the end instead. The album is called Dividing Horizon. It was released in 2015. You can check it out. It's on Spotify and all the usual streaming sorts of things.
So got a Bandcamp page as well, yeah.
Yep, that's what I've got for you there. Socionics, Dividing Horizon. How about you? What do you got for me, mate?
Okay, so we spoke about Gary Verkamp earlier in the show with his album that he's just done with Mark Zonder. He is of Shadow Gallery fame, so I'm going to give you a record by Shadow Gallery. This is their self-titled debut album from 1992.
Ooh, okay, awesome.
I was going to give you a different record, but for the benefit of our fans, that one is not available to stream. I was going to give you Room V. Well, I think it's Room 5, but that one is from 2005. That's probably my favorite of their albums. But that one is not available to stream, so you're getting their debut record instead.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, I've heard Room 5.
So you have heard that one.
I have heard Room 5. That's the one that I have heard. And I don't know whether or not I've heard this one. So I can't remember hearing it, but I can't remember what I had for breakfast. So that's fine. So I think that brings us tidily to the end of the episode.
What are we going to talk about next time, though, Dave?
Next time is a remarkable, remarkable, remarkable question.
I guess we're going to have to review the new Two album.
I was going to say, we are going to be going track by track on the brand new Tool album, Fear Inoculum. So strap in for that one, because it is going to be a hell of an episode, and an episode that I have been, well, an album I've been waiting to listen to for 14 years, and it's going to be an episode that I've been waiting to do since they first announced that, you know, hey, we're actually releasing a new album. And Hoggy will tell you I have been nothing short of a Japanese schoolgirl being very giddy and anime-eyed for this entire thing. So
he's definitely not lying, people. It's totally true.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Something else that we probably should cover next time around is we made a bit of a crack in the last show about other bands that are releasing albums on the same day as Tool. We probably should have a look at a few of those, I think. What do you think?
I think we will most definitely be doing that, at least having a look, a cursory glance at some of the albums that are coming out on the day of the new Tool album.
So I think that about wraps it up for this show. If you want to find the show notes for this episode, you can find them at the98podcast.fireside.fm/37. Uh-huh. You can contact us on our contact form on our website from there, and feel free to tweet at us at 98FM to give us your feedback on this show, or indeed any of the other shows that we've put out on this podcast.
Absolutely, absolutely. But thank you again for joining us for another walk down the prog world of Australia and underground world of Australia. My name is David Ellis.
My name is Alex Hogg. We shall see you all next time.
See you then.